Hello and welcome to episode 38 of the Mindfulness Hub. My name is Aileen Perez and today I have the honor of sharing this space with someone I admire a lot. Welcome, Max.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So Max Strom has several TED Talks, 30 years of experience in breathwork, personal transformation. You also have a background in Qigong and yoga, and I would like you to share about how the journey began.
That's always I always find that challenging, but I'm happy to do it. But I'm always unsure what to leave out and what to leave in, you know. But I think the most important part is that I started becoming interested in personal transformation at an unusual age of 15. So I started reading basically any book I could get my hands on philosophy, spirituality. I did comparative religion study. So by the time I was about 18 or 19, I'd basically done a university level of study, but on my own, choosing my own books and my own way of doing it. And I was already meditating by 16, Qigong by 18. And it was very lonely because there was also no one else that I knew that was studying any of this. In those days, it was much different than now, you know, where, I mean, there's a new personal transformation book coming out every week, probably, or more. There's a new breathwork, a breathing book coming out constantly. Only 10 years ago, there were only about 5 books on breathing. And when I was a teenager, I don't know of any. I mean, there are a couple of yoga books that included breathwork. My point is, it wasn't an emphasis in society in those days. So it was quite lonely. And eventually I became very frustrated and I wasn't happy. I didn't do a good job finding my way in this world. And I have a very artistic side. So eventually I went into the field of music and I was in that for about roughly 11, 12 years. And I put out a couple vinyl records in those days. And I took a year off. 1987, to write a screenplay. Long story short, I decided to continue doing that and to step out of the music business, which was, the music business is very tough unless you make it very big. Otherwise, you can be quite well known, but still make almost no money and you're wondering how you're going to make ends meet. So at some point, I decided that's enough. I was 30, 31 years old, and I said it. I gave it my best shot, and I really like writing screenplays, and people seemed to like my writing right away. I got some attention for my writing, so I did that for 8 or 9 years. And while I was immersing myself in that, I found a yoga studio 3 blocks away from where I was living, and that was the original Yoga Works. They only had one room. And ultimately, they ended up with 300 locations around the world. So it was really, I think, the most important studio in the United States that I just happened to live near and happened to start practicing it. So I was really at the right place at the right time because they had great teachers visiting from all over the world. And I just fell in love with it and started practicing 6 days a week. And it really changed my life and I started to feel happy. Yeah. That was really the key thing. I started to feel happy and my friends noticed that I started to look happy. Smiled more. And so that at some point I just stepped out of the movie business and just started teaching classes. And I moved into a yurt, that's Mongolian tent, in the woods. And I lived there for 10 years.
Wow.
And I was teaching in Los Angeles.
Something that caught me a lot from the experience you shared about yoga was how stretching the muscles combined with deep breathing help the nervous system to calm down while contractions make us go to fight or flight mode. And how can we suggest people who are constantly under stress or their muscles are constantly contracting to give a try to breathwork? Because I feel that many people haven't really explored the power of breathing.
No, it's becoming more well known now and more accepted because a lot of very extreme sports type of men are doing it. So such as, the Navy SEALs use breath work now. Other special forces groups that I've spoken to use breath work to aid them. For example, if they're about to jump out of an airplane.
I actually skydive.
Yes.
You do breath
work. Yes. Helps to stay calm.
Yeah, or at least not as excited. It might not calm you down, but if it calms you down 50%, that's helpful. True. So the militaries all over the world have adopted it. And I learned recently, I met a sniper, former sniper, used it just before pulling the trigger, so that it's even used in warfare. And then you have these free divers who are famous now, and you have Wim Hof has become quite famous, who swims under the ice and encourages people to do ice therapy. So it sort of fit into the community of extreme sports. So guys, especially men, right, who may have looked down on it now are thinking, well, if Navy SEALs do it, maybe I should do it, because it's macho. But before that, it was just some crazy yoga thing or crazy qigong thing, and people weren't so open to it. But yes, about contracting muscles, a lot of people don't know that most workouts consist of just contracting muscles, not lengthening them. So it fits more into the fight or flight mold. I mean, if you're sprinting, you're either running at something or running away from something originally. It wasn't a sport originally. It was skull staying alive. So we need aerobic type exercise. We need contraction-based exercise. But that alone does not heal us in terms of our anxiety and depression. Because we all know people who work out every day, who live on anti-anxiety drugs and antidepressants and sleep medication. So we know that. People were surrounded by people like that. So we can't fool ourselves to thinking, I just need to run or I just need to go to the gym and that solves all of my problems internally. Stretching the muscles triggers the relaxation response that we're looking for, which helps us to sleep and not be anxious. And then breath work, of course, does the same thing, only perhaps even more so.
And I wanted to catch on that point where you said that men are somehow struggling to express their emotions. And it's like socially unaccepted for a guy to cry or just to acknowledge how they feel. And when we bottle up emotions, that ends up becoming anxiety, right?
Yes, that's right. And this is a problem around the world, and I think it has been for some time. And I grew up in a household where I was trained to not express physical pain, emotional pain, fear, loneliness, shame. None of these things were even discussed. You just didn't talk about it. Someone died in the family. I was told by my mother, father, so-and-so passed away. But I never saw my parents cry. I imagine that they did, but it was probably in private. So I did not then learn to grieve myself because I had no model
of how to grieve.
Pattern myself after, right? So I understand this form of life because I grew up in it. I went, at one point, I think 10 years without crying, so I completely understand. It was very hard for me to cry, even if I wanted to. So I just want to say, first of all, I understand this point of view. I understand how one thinks. And I understand how, as a man, you might feel that being vulnerable is the last thing you should do because you'll lose your status in society as a man. And it will make women, if you're interested in women, uninterested in you. And there's a partial truth to that, I think, where there are some women who would react very negatively to that. Due to their own
belief.
Belief system, less than ideal belief system or upbringing. But there are plenty of good women who do not react that way.
And appreciate all the vulnerability.
Yeah, because you can't just suppress certain emotions. That's the thing that I've learned, not only through my own infrastructure, but working with so many people, tens of thousands of people, that if you think, well, here are my sliders, like your dimmer switches on your lights, right? And I'm going to just pull down fear, loneliness, shame.
Grief.
Grief, that's a big one. Yeah, pull that one way down. Never cry. It doesn't seem to work that way. When we start pulling down these dimmers, we start pulling the other ones down as well, to where we are not so good at expressing love or joy or forgiveness.
There is one of your, well, it's actually the introduction to your talks that really resonated with me, because you ask your audience how many people were training CPR, and plenty of them were raising their hands, but when you ask if they had a clue of how to manage emotions, not many people were prepared. And then you said that we know what to do when the heart stops, but not when the heart breaks. And I felt that is very true and profound, because nowadays we are so used to suppress emotions, but how does this impact our nervous system and how does this become trauma?
Well, one of the things I've been studying for a while now is how we are a tribal species. And we know that, but we don't sometimes really go into what does that mean in terms of our instincts. I think people are normally aware of certain instincts we have, the real obvious ones, the survival instincts, you know, food, water,
sleep,
mating with someone at some point. We have these instincts, but we also have instincts as a tribe, which causes us, for example, to go to sports arenas and dress in the same colors and sing the same songs and lock arms at a football game or something like that in the audience. That's all tribal. And nobody dislikes fire in terms of a fireplace or a campfire. People love to sit around a fire. It doesn't matter who they are, and just stare at it, because we've been staring at fire for a million years or something like that. Even our, you know, distant ancestors have had fire for a long time. So if you observe how tribes lived, so they were usually around 30 to 60 people. That's it. That's everybody you would ever know in your whole life. If you really think about that, you're not going to meet anybody new. And if you do, you're probably going to have a little battle with some friends. First of all, in that environment, there are no secrets. It'd be extremely hard to keep a secret from your tribe, because those are the only ones you see every day, and you work closely together to get food and process food. So also then, we all know everyone, so if someone passes away, we would grieve as a tribe. We would not grieve alone. I would say, well, that's your father, but I've known your father since I was a child. Or maybe your mother or your grandmother also nursed me. There's a saying in Africa, all women are my mother.
Yeah.
But they actually mean it literally, because all the women in the tribe would nurse you at some point. You know, all the women take care of the babies. Yeah. So every death would be a tribal event, every marriage, every birth, and every breakup, divorce type situation would be a tribal event. Every loss of a child, every miscarriage would be a tribal event, and we would mourn and grieve together. And we've lost that. Now, there are still places in the world where they still do it. I bet some people who describe this to me. I just want to mention one, a man, one of my trainings, he's from Africa, has a beautiful French accent, and he told me in the village where he grew up, everyone had very small houses, and they had a big common area. If you had a crisis, your family and friends would come to your house and sit inside with you. But if it was a really big crisis, the whole village would come and surround your house and just sit there quietly, maybe talking a little bit, drinking some tea. So if you looked out your window, you'd see the whole tribe is there for you. And they're just sitting there. And the nonverbal language of that is so intensely powerful. If you imagine in your own life, it affects your heart right away. Without saying a word, the fact that it shows that you matter, your pain matters to them. This is instinctive. And when he moved to, when this man I'm telling you about moved to Europe, he found out that that doesn't happen there. And especially when he moved to Holland, where I live. And a lot of the people in the training were from Holland. And he said, I talked to another man from the same village who was living there. And I said, what do they do when there's a crisis? He says, they all walk away. No one calls him. And he said, what? And he said, I couldn't believe it. He said, it upset me so much. He says, why would they abandon you? He said, I don't know. That's just what they do here. And so he looked around the room. He said, I'm ashamed of Holland for this. But everybody looked down. But it's not just Holland. As we know, it's most of Europe, especially in the northern European countries, North America, where I'm from. Lots of places. Most places. But there are still some tribes like the one where he's from, where it's normal, natural to grieve with you. And it makes you feel the three most important things we need for well-being, in my opinion. To feel seen and heard, to feel emotionally safe, and to feel that we matter at least, or maybe even we're loved. And when I say emotionally safe, I don't mean the way it's being talked about in the media these days, where they say, you know, I want to be, I never want to be offended, or never want my feelings hurt. That's not what I mean. Because the world is full of offense. You'll never be offended. Just get in your car and drive two blocks and some other driver is going to offend you. So what I mean by emotionally safe is like the man I just described in the village. He knows that if he goes through a crisis, he will not be abandoned. That people will come toward him, not away from him. They won't think any less of him for it. Because they also know that when they're in a crisis, the same things can happen with them.
It's interesting because I feel that nowadays, despite having social media and phones, we're not bonding with humans as before. And that
social media. That's exactly why.
And this loneliness also makes us feel isolated, even if we are surrounded by people. I'm just thinking that...
Yeah, people are even lonely in their marriages. If they feel like they've lost connection with their spouse, a lot of marriages are very lonely places.
Do you think that it's human nature to seek for connection?
Yes. As I was saying, I think it's our tribal nature that we must have it. I mean, if you look at... Let's look at an American prison, for example. American prisons are not so nice places compared to some other countries. For example, Holland, I taught in a Dutch prison recently. And it was the nicest prison I could have imagined. Really, really civilized. The American prisons, you're always in danger. But how do they punish you if you do something really bad in prison?
They send you alone.
They put you in isolation. People would rather be in an area where their life is in danger than be locked in a room by themselves. That's how strong of an instinct that we have to be with the tribe. We feel like there's an existential threat to us if we are isolated. The Aboriginals in Australia, I was reading that when they first started getting locked up by the British who owned Australia in the early days, some of them would just die. Like within a few days, they would just die. They could not be locked up.
Hello.
And now that doesn't happen so much anymore. I think they're more exposed to Western ways. But the rate of suicide is extremely high. They cannot stand to be locked up because they live outdoors, completely outdoors. And that to be put in a box is just too much for them.
I guess that losing freedom is also compromising their mental health.
That's right. So loneliness is really deadly for us. If you think about this tribal instinct to gather, as I've said, around the campfire, it explains why addiction groups like AA work, or group therapy works, or support groups men, women, whatever kind of support group you have, works. Because when we get together in a group and we give each other permission to speak about what's most important, it enriches us and it makes us healthier emotionally.
And how does breath work and breathing helps us connect with those emotions that we may not be able to express?
Well, in terms of science, the neuroscientists, at least the ones that I've spoken to, they still don't know. It's still a mystery, but there's still a lot of mysteries around the brain. For example, they still don't know where thoughts come from. They don't really know how we have thoughts. It's a mystery. They don't know why we have to dream or we go insane, and they don't know how emotions and our breath are interconnected, but we know they are. For example, the first thing we all did when we were born was inhale and start to cry. First act on this earth was to breathe and cry. So it's instinctive, it's encoded, it's not taught to us. Not crying is taught to us later. But the breath seems to access our subconscious. It seems to open a door to our subconscious, which means memory, emotions, and our association with certain events. We call that trauma. So because we are taught either by our parents, by our society, or on the schoolyard when we're children to suppress certain emotions, if you're taught that, you're not allowed to grieve. Yet grieving is a natural thing. We were given to process our emotions. I often say, you don't process grief. Grief is the processing function of our subconscious. So if you don't allow yourself to do that, you push it down. You just shove it down in your chest, put some cement over it till the next one comes along, push that one down, cover it with cement. So we have all this living pain locked in our body.
And I feel that, sorry to interrupt, I feel like for these kind of situations, people will look for coping mechanisms instead of healing.
Exactly.
And that's different.
Yeah. That's where the alcohol comes in. That's where all
addictions.
Any kind of addiction comes in. But what breathwork can do, and that's why, this is why I think we need to do it first in a healing regimen, is it opens the door and lets all those old wounds breathe again, ventilate, and it restarts the healing program. The way I like to describe it is this. If you imagine a pond, and we'll say the pond is the heart, and I'm going to toss a pebble with an idea of healing into the pond, but the pond is frozen. Well, at least the surface is frozen. There's a few centimeters of ice. And using symbolism, you know, the pond is, the water's emotion. And the freezing is that cement I've been telling you about, the cementing over your emotions. So if I toss this pebble, it just bounces and skips across the ice and nothing happens. But if I do breath work, the warm breath starts to melt the ice. And then the water that melts escapes out of our ice. And then the pebble sinks down into the pond deeply. And this is why the Sufis, for example, have a saying that breathwork opens the eyes and ears of the heart. That things it could not see or hear before, now it can once you do breathwork.
That is beautiful. And I really feel that breathwork was a life-changing experience, at least for me. So what would you suggest to those who are still skeptical about breathwork?
Come see me for 10 minutes. I'll work with you for 10 minutes, and 10 minutes, and you will feel different. Even if you're skeptical, even if you're cynical, as long as you do it exactly the way I say, you will feel a result within 10 minutes.
I totally agree. There is one more thing that, well, I don't have many years of experience in breathwork, as you do, but in the few years that I've been dedicated to learn more about the subject, I've experienced different type of breath works, and then I began free diving, and I feel that in the breath hold part, it was like not only a meditation, it was going somewhere deep in my mind that I would never imagine accessing. And it was confronting my fears. It was shedding a lot of beliefs that were making me feel unsafe. So how can we use breath work for dealing with our fears?
Dealing with our fears?
Mm-hmm. Or with anxiety or with depression.
Well, when you push the emotions down and you don't allow them to, you don't allow yourself to grieve. Think of this phrase, grieve to heal.
Mm-hmm.
Not just breathe to heal, but grieve to heal. So if you don't allow yourself to grieve and you just freeze it, mm-hmm. and then the next thing, this creates anxiety. The energy has to come out somewhere. It'll start coming out as anxiety, including sleep problems. If you can't contain it anymore, we call that a panic attack. So by using breath work to release all of this frozen, imprisoned emotion, it releases all that. The healing process begins again. The anxiety goes away. But it's not only breath work. Breath work is a major part of it, but we also need a tribe. We also need people close to us to show us that we matter, and they're not afraid or ashamed of our grief, and they stand by us during the worst of times. Now, someone listening to this might take it to the opposite extreme and think, Max thinks we should all be crying all the time. And obviously, I don't mean that. In fact, there's so many times where you need to keep yourself under control as a parent, at work, especially driving a car. But there's a huge distance between crying all the time and never crying for two decades. And so maybe we can find a middle ground where after we've been through something, when the dust is settled and we're safe, then we release it with our tribe, with witnesses, not alone in a room. It's not the same. It's completely different how we respond to witnesses. And then it's okay, and we move on. We don't have to continue to cry every day or anything. But we have to do it. We have to do it. This is how we're designed, evidently. And if we don't, we have anxiety, panic attacks, depression, and severe sleep problems, which are so common.
And actually, we have a class here dedicated to sleep every Saturday at 7 p.m. And it's interesting because we had a case of a guy who was complaining about insomnia for a while. And, well, basically what I do in my class, it's a combination of breathwork, yoga nidra, and it's just a sensory journey where people can just allow themselves to relax. And that guy overslept. The next day he didn't go to work, right? So,
it's really astonishing after a session of strong breathwork, people will say, I went home and fell asleep with my shoes on the couch and didn't wake up till morning.
And it's so true, because I feel that nowadays we're so in a rush that we don't even dedicate time to wind down and listen to what's happening to our bodies. And there's so many people out there that probably are questioning, oh, but I don't have time for that. Like, we make time for the things that we consider a priority. And I think that sleep quality is a very important priority in our lives. Not everybody considers it, though.
Well, what I would say to someone who says, I don't have time, I would say, look on your phone, your smartphone, where it tells you how many hours you used that week.
True.
That's a lot of time that you've put into that phone. It's not just checking where do I have to go next or answering an important message. It's all those other hours. You have plenty of time to do this. You don't have time not to do it, because it's like I often say when people are cynical. I say, if what you're doing now is working, you don't need breath work. But if you're living off medications just to function in this crazy world, maybe you should try something new.
I totally agree. And it's just the basics like sleeping or breathing that we forget about. Because we think that we need to be 24/7 busy. And I think that if we dedicated the same amount of energy to healing, maybe there would be less anxiety and depression out there.
That's exactly right. But there has to be some education as to, well, how do we heal? What is necessary to help us to heal? And I think that, as I mentioned earlier, there's not much knowledge about that.
And you have two books. One of them is A Life Worth Breathing. And the second one is...
There is no app for happiness.
For happiness. And it was because you were with a friend. Yeah. And
she just bought a phone.
Yes.
And she was scrolling through it. She said, there's an app for everything. I said, see if there's one for happiness. This was around 2010, 2009. And she looked. And she said, no, there's not. I said, I didn't think so.
What would you suggest to those who are still looking for an app for happiness?
We have a choice between virtual reality and reality. I think when we're at our deathbed, when we're very old, none of us are going to say, I really wish I'd spent more time on my phone.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to happen.
At all.
And the segment of society that spends the most time on their phone, which is the younger people, like late teens and 20s, they, Gen Z, I think it's called, they, yeah, Gen Z. So they, when they're interviewed, claim to be extremely lonely, not have real friends they can connect with, not know how to make friends, not know how to date. A lot of people don't date anymore because they don't know how. They just live on their phone. So there might be a connection between the people who live on their phones the most, who happen to be the loneliest. It used to be only the real, you know, the people in the last 10 years of their life that were the loneliest, but not anymore.
And it's interesting that you're mentioning even dating has changed nowadays because people go on dating apps and you're not really using your social skills. So it's so important to just look for human connection in the real world, I guess.
Human connection is food. It's the richest kind of food for us. We love it. And if we don't have it, we starve.
And if there were three advices that you would give to someone who is new in this beautiful journey of breathwork and healing, what would it be?
Work with a breathing teacher whose main purpose is to help you with anxiety, not just do extreme stuff, not just to hallucinate, because there are those breathing sessions that will make you hallucinate. So rather than approach it as an extreme sport, approach it as a healing modality. And and breathe with other people who are breathing. So don't just do it alone watching YouTube. Do it. Come to a studio like this one and do it with a tribe. And understand that really the only benefit that crises have, other than just teaching us new skills in life, is that they help us connect to other people. For example, can I give you an example?
Of course, as many as you'd like.
Well, there's something called the Blitz Spirit. If you look in Wikipedia under the Blitz Spirit, there's a nice article about it. In the World War II, before my time, at the beginning of the war, near the beginning of the war, I think it was 1940, the German Air Force attacked England. They started bombing civilian cities rather than military targets. And their idea was, if we bomb them enough, they're going to be really frightened and they're going to give up. They're going to petition the government to surrender. We don't have to invade them. We can just do it through the air. Had exactly the opposite effect. They call it the Blitz Spirit because the Blitz was the attack. That was named by the media, the attack, the Blitz. The Blitz Spirit was how people reacted to it. And psychologists, psychiatrists were tracking human beings' reactions to this aerial bombardment, which was a new thing in the world. And what they found was people came together, and neighbors who had never spoken to each other became best friends, and homeless people who had no purpose suddenly were helping pull people out of the rubble and saving people's lives, and went around with big smiles on their face, became part of the community. Alcoholism went down to almost nothing. Domestic violence went down to almost nothing. Murder disappeared. Stealing, everything. Crime basically ceased to exist as everybody came together like a tribe to work against this common enemy. But not only that, it wasn't just a battle. It was, how do I help you? How do you help me? We're all in this together. And so it raised their spirits, so to speak, into something that had never been seen before. And of course, we've seen that many times since then. This happened during 9/11 in the United States, mm-hmm. for example. New York was known as the meanest, nastiest city in the United States. Mm-hmm. And a few weeks later, it was known as the kindest city in the United States.
Wow.
And I wanted to thank you one more time for sharing all your wisdom in this space. I am very honored of being here with you and just listening to all this knowledge that you've been spreading all over the world. Thank you so much, Max.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. It's been a real pleasure to meet you and to speak in here.
Thanks again. And we've reached the end of episode 38. Feel free to contact me on aileen.yoga@gmail.com or through Instagram, aileen_yoga. I look forward to speaking with you next week in the Mindfulness Hub.